Welcome to the EP Edit. This is a podcast dedicated to topics of interest in the field of cardiac electrophysiology. I'm Jody Elrod, Managing Editor of EP Lab Digest. In this episode, we feature a conversation with Dr. Rod Passman and Dr. Jody Hurwitz, President of the Heart Rhythm Society, about the selection of authors for HRS clinical guidelines, how atrial fibrillation guidelines will change practice, the impact of pulse field ablation, and the role of HRS in maintaining high-quality care in interventional AFib therapies.
Hello, I'm Dr. Rod Passman, and we're talking today from the Western AFib Symposium, and it is my pleasure to have the opportunity to speak with Dr. Jody Hurwitz, the president of the Heart Rhythm Society. Jody, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So this is a really interesting time in our field. We're at the Western AFib meeting. There's a lot of great technology coming out. And our guidelines were recently released about atrial fibrillation. And I think a lot of people want to know, what's the process of choosing people for HRS guidelines? How do people come involved? And sort of how do we deal with the fact that, you know, we are individuals often tied to industry. That's how we move this field forward. So tell me the HRS position on how you choose these people and how you strike those balances.
Okay. Thank you for the question. Very important. So really, when there are guidelines that are decided to be published and researched, things go through the SCDC, the Scientific Documents Clinical Committee. And the idea is that there is an advertisement, if you will, that goes out to all of the members about becoming involved in these guidelines. There's a nominations group that people submit their names. They fill out an extensive amount of information about what their interest is, why they should be involved in this. Obviously, as you commented, any kind of relationships with industry. Those names go back to the SCDC committee. They're reviewed. They're also reviewed through the ethics committee. Then there's a selection, if you will, and those names go to the executive committee and the Board of Trustees, who review the selections, and then they go back to the SCDC. The important thing is that the chair and at least one of the co-chairs of these committees need to have no involvement with industry, and the recommendation is at least 50% of each of the working committees have no involvement with industry. Obviously, this is a real sticking point. It's, you know, one of the big things that I comment on all the time. Our field is importantly involved with industry. So to have these committees include people who have no relationships with industry 100% really, I think, would be a detriment to these guidelines.
Yeah, I think that the pendulum has swung a bit, because I do think there was an era where no one on the writing committee had contact. But as you mentioned, our field moves forward from those interactions. I think they're really important. So it sounds like a balance has been struck, and I think that balance is fair.
So far, looks great.
So I think the guidelines have some really interesting things. As someone pointed out, it's over 400 pages. Is that true?
Not quite that long, okay. But it's really long. It takes, I think, as people have said, it takes a good weekend to go through everything. But
So what stands out to you as sort of outstanding in terms of this is going to change the way we practice medicine, that we practice how we care for patients with atrial fibrillation? What were the most remarkable changes to you?
So also a great question. I think that one of the most important things that the guidelines has now done is included a class 1 indication for atrial fibrillation ablation for the treatment of patients who have atrial fibrillation. I could comment that it's also a class 1 indication now for patients who have heart failure for ablation. But I think this really supports our discussion with patients. It enables us to really give them some data. It's no surprise that it helps with payers as well, so that we can work forward and push the envelope in that direction. I think one of the most important things that these guidelines offered us are a staging of atrial fibrillation. And I think that the notion that atrial fibrillation is a continuum and that this is something that we all, not only electrophysiologists, but cardiology and internal medicine, we have to start looking for patients earlier so that we can get involved with their care earlier and change things going forward. There are very specific, concrete recommendations in terms of treating some of the, as they say, the steps, if you will, So not just treat the hypertension, not just treat the obesity, but really giving concrete suggestions. The other thing that we've heard a lot about over the last several years, and I'm really delighted to see in the guidelines, is the fact that early treatment for atrial fibrillation is really paramount to helping our patients.
Yeah, I think those are huge changes, and it sort of gets into something that someone said yesterday. You know, this is an incredibly complicated disease, and you know, when we see patients referred or to us, as opposed to diseases like high blood pressure and high cholesterol, where maybe primary care doctors feel pretty comfortable, you know, is atrial fibrillation just gotten so complex that this is clearly the domain of not even a cardiologist, but an electrophysiologist to deal with most patients? Or are we just not communicating sort of the ABCs to our primary care colleagues?
Obviously something that you're passionate about. No, it's definitely not the purview of only electrophysiologists. I really think that, and it behooves us to better educate those people who essentially refer to us. But I think it's really important, and again, this is really a personal opinion, as I think you probably have personal opinions about this too, that we need to get people involved in the notion of what's going to ultimately cause people to have atrial fibrillation much earlier than we've been doing this now. Obviously, the ablation procedures, and you know, we can talk about that for a while, are the purview of electrophysiologists. And you know, but in the beginning treatment, really, we need everybody, all physicians, to help us with this.
And I think we need to expend a lot of energy, sort of undoing the damage that caused, like a firm did, right? Because there are a lot of people, I think, who aren't electrophysiologists, who aren't going to read our guidelines, right, and not recognize how important early intervention is and perhaps offer ablation even as first-line therapy.
Right.
So I think a lot of these patients may be cared for and not getting state-of-the-art care. So you know, communicating that to our cardiology referrals and internal medicine referrals, I think, really is important.
Right, right. And that can sort of go to some of the derivatives of the guidelines and how we can get the message out, not only to obviously our peers in electrophysiology, but again, all the people who ultimately will refer these patients to us. We need a little bit better ability to educate them. Right.
So obviously there's so much excitement about PFA. This technology has just been approved in the United States. We're going to have two companies. So how do you foresee this changing kind of the practice of EP? I mean, you and I have been doing this long enough to see the AFib ablation go from a multi-hour procedure to maybe one that's safer. Maybe we could offer it to patients who would otherwise wouldn't consider. And certainly, you know, reduce the time that it takes and the radiation exposure and the risks involved. So what do you foresee as the future? Is this going to be done more as a result? Are we going to offer it to sicker patients or frailer patients that maybe we would be more concerned about collateral damage? So where do you think it's going to fall?
I probably can talk about this for quite a while. So I just will kind of highlight a few things. I think what I'd really like to enforce is what seems to be the safety data with PFA. And I think that in comparison to the thermal ablation energies that we've been using for atrial fibrillation ablation, I think that the notion that we can do this quicker and therefore that makes it better is probably not the right way to approach this. These procedures using PFA as an energy source really still needs to be done by an electrophysiologist. This is an EP issue. It will be interesting to see the widespread adoption of PFA. Unfortunately, right now, some of the payers don't see the benefits of PFA the same way I think that we do. So I think that there are some hurdles there that we need to overcome. I think that, you know, as we drive this whole field forward, we do better for our patients, which is fantastic. And I really do think that PFA is really going to be, for the time being, the energy source that we will all be using for ablations.
I know. Do you have any concerns about sort of how HRS maintains quality, right? I mean, now we have a better tool, the threshold for recommending it and the expertise may be needed may change over time. So how do we ensure that we maintain sort of the quality that HRS is known for as this and procedure maybe grows in numbers exponentially.
Yeah, one always worries about something that's brand new coming, you know, down the pike, that everybody wants to just jump on the bandwagon without really getting an appropriate sense of education on how to use these tools. And I think that that's exactly where HRS can help with education. You know, competition, if you will, amongst companies, I think that that's actually very healthy. I think that drives the field forward. I think that we make sure that the studies that are done are appropriate, that they include the right patients, that we get the right information from that. You know, we have a very robust health policy committee that really looks at all of this in detail. And I think that supporting them and getting the data out from them is going to be very helpful.
That's good to know. Okay, I have one last question for you. What's the best part about being HRS president?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, other people have said this before. I think it's the people. It's just amazing to me how many people all over the world I wind up getting to meet. You know, you are involved in absolutely everything, and that's really wonderful. You get to learn an awful lot about a lot of different things. The HRS staff is incredible. And I think, you know, I've been in electrophysiology for a long period of time, and I think I still find the field absolutely fantastic, interesting. We're moving forward. This is a really fun time to be in electrophysiology again, and I think HRS really supports that. And so as president, it's really fun to be able to be out there in front helping move this field forward.
That's a great answer. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking your time to speak with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
We'd like to thank our participants for joining us today. For more information about EP Lab Digest, please visit eplabdigest.com. Thanks for listening.